Hi, welcome to another edition of Ian Wallace, the Messed Up Counsellor. Today I've got a guest in the studio, which is Steve. Hi, welcome.
Hi,
Steve.
There. Hi.
Steve specialises in pornography, addiction and those kind of areas of work. And we're going to be talking about that, obviously, from Steve's point of view, because he's the specialist in that area. But probably talking also widening the context up into different aspects of the work of addiction in general, if you like, and hopefully give people an understanding of what it's about, what it is. How do you know you're addicted? Which is probably a good starting point. So okay. How do you know you're addicted, Steve? What is an addiction?
Well, it takes people a long time sometimes to realise they've got an addiction. But usually they will start to notice when they experience negative consequences. So there'll be an impact on their work, their relationships, their health, and other aspects of their life will start to suffer.
How would they see that in real life, the negative consequences? What might be happening for them?
Well, typically, they will start to probably isolate from partners, from family. Their work performance will start to decline because they don't have the energy or the concentration. Sometimes they might lose money and start to get into debt. I mean, the consequences are very diverse, obviously.
Yeah. But that will affect, presumably, relationships around them.
Very much so, yeah. I find in my line of work, because sex and porn addiction does impact on relationships quite considerably, that it's partners that often notice things. They discover things or they have suspicions, and they will then nudge their partner to go and seek help.
And I suppose that comes with, certainly with anything to do around sex, it comes with shame, embarrassment and guilt.
Yeah, very much so. Yeah, and I think that's one of the reasons why people stay in denial for a long, long time, because it's very difficult to face up to, you know, what you've been doing and, you know, the effect it's having on your life.
And I guess, you know, partners who have people that they intimately connect to in a relationship, that presumably makes it really awkward for them to have a emotionally intimate sexual relationship sometimes.
Do you mean for the addict?
Yeah.
Yeah, very much so, yeah. I mean, this is one of the things that partners notice. They notice that their addict partner or potentially addict partner is perhaps withdrawing a bit from communications and being less intimate, getting involved much less with activities with the children, if they've got children. There might be a lot of unaccounted for time where they're not around. So partners notice this sort of withdrawal sometimes.
And I suppose in some senses that withdrawing, they will see that as them not interested in their partner, which might not necessarily be the case.
Yeah, you've hit on something there. So with sex and porn addiction, there is a what we call a huge sensitization to particular forms of arousal. So that takes the attention away from the regular physical relationship. So there's a lot of natural biological disinterest in regular sexual relationships, because the porn or the acting out online, cyber sex, webcamming and so on, it just overtakes the arousal system.
So they kind of need more and more stimuli to to get aroused.
Yeah, I understand.
That and I suppose that's a really hard word to take on board, addict, isn't it? To see yourself as an addict or to hear that word.
I mentioned the word denial earlier. This is a very big factor that stops people from seeking help. Somehow their addict brains convince them that there's not a problem. As long as other people don't know about it and they function okay and they hide what they're doing, they can convince themselves, or the addict part of their brain convinces them that, yeah, it's all right, you know, there's not a major problem here.
Mm.
But there are limitations, and eventually the negative consequences kick in so hard that people are eventually pushed into getting some kind of help, or they mess up in some way, yeah, consciously or unconsciously, and somebody discovers it. Most of the time it's a partner, but unfortunately sometimes it's also an employer or the police or vigilantes. So sex and porn addiction is a dangerous game for people who are deeply into denial.
Absolutely, yeah, yeah. And as you said, it only usually gets worse and worse and worse until it comes off the rails in some way, shape or form.
It does. There is an escalating factor, and if we consider that most sex and porn addicts start when they're about 11, 12, the onset of puberty, a curiosity about sex, they find a magazine, nowadays they'll discover the internet, of course, and it takes off from there. So I'm meeting new clients who are now in their sort of mid to late 30s who have been doing this a long, long time. But, you know, I've also had clients in their 60s and 70s who have been in denial for a lifetime. But something's happened to bring them into therapy, because, yeah, the secret's been held for so long, but they've been discovered in some way, or something dreadful has happened.
Yeah, yeah. And you mentioned there the addict brain, and I guess people who have a partner that's addicted, I guess they'll see it as a personal thing. They don't want me, they want porn, which I would imagine is a normal kind of reaction to most people. But they won't necessarily know what the addict brain is, will they? Can you say a bit more about that?
Yeah, so you're quite right. A partner will usually see these behaviours as a rejection. They're not good enough. They're not attractive enough anymore. Any form of sexual acting out is in effect for a partner an affair. It's the same kind of violation of the intimacy. Yeah, we wouldn't expect partners to understand the science of addiction and the neuroscience behind it. We have to help partners work through the trauma of discovery, and find their own way with this big change in their life now. I do offer partners brief work, a session, maybe two at most, before I refer them on to get their own help, but I do try and help them understand that this is not about them. They're 99.9% of the time not the cause, and it's important for them to know that, understand that. And I do help them answer questions I have about why, you know, why is my husband, boyfriend, girlfriend, why have they been doing this for 10, 15 years? And, you know, explaining some of the science can help.
Yeah, I guess so. And I suppose that partner finding their own way of supporting themselves whilst you're working, because I would imagine your kind of work with addicts is not short-term work, in the sense that it's not a couple of sessions.
No.
So how long really kind of would it take to understand it, work with it, get to a process of being in control of it, in your experience?
If we were to look at averages, I'd say it's between 4 and 7 months to get into an early recovery. And then it's usually at that stage up to the client to go off and manage things independently with the tools that they learn in the therapy sessions.
Yeah.
You can probably understand that an objective of mine and my work is not to keep clients forever.
No.
It's important that they learn to manage this and take responsibility for their behaviours, not rely on a therapist. Yeah, probably 4 to 7 months. Within that period, people are usually in a safe place.
Yeah, yeah. And I suppose if their partner can get that support, that's invaluable for them to kind of hold them, if you like, in a process of somewhere to go, somewhere to talk about. Because again, there'll probably be that shame, embarrassment process. Mm. Can't talk to my friend about it or my family or whoever. So I suppose having the partner getting their own support is helpful.
Yeah, the partner aspect of this, if the addict is in a relationship, of course, is as critical, if not more critical, than work for the addict. Usually an addict commits to the work, they take responsibility, they want to make big changes. And I think this is often a product of people now knowing it's not a secret anymore. Mm. And they, you know, they want to take responsibility and do the right thing.
Yeah.
So they're usually ready to get into recovery. Often, to use a client's words that I often hear, they want to move on, move forward with their lives. For a partner, it's just not that easy. This is a huge trauma. And yeah, they benefit a lot from support. But obviously it's not for me to tell them to get support. No. I can only encourage. Addicts themselves can only encourage their partners to get help. Mm. But it's a difficult one, because some partners feel, why should they be getting help? You know, this is not a problem they've created.
No, it's just a problem that they've become aware of or connected to.
Yeah. But it deeply affects most partners, and the trauma is likely to be more long lasting if they don't seek out help.
And I suppose that can help if they are in a couple relationship, that can help the couple, because if the partner understands it a bit more and is being supported, then they're probably going to be more able to connect to the relationship.
Yes, I mean, obviously all partners are different. Some are stronger, some have a broader outlook on things. They recognise that being addicted to porn is not the same violation of intimacy as perhaps having an affair is.
Mm.
But other partners, they really struggle with it, understandably.
Yeah.
But if they are generally a little bit more sensitive to relationship dynamics, then yeah, they're going to be hit harder.
Mm. Yeah, which is really destructive, isn't it?
Very destructive. This is the thing about addiction. You know, it's both self-destructive for the addict, but it eventually has an impact on the people around them, partners, their children, friends, family. Where the secret is shared with family, you know, there's like a ripple effect. And it's very difficult.
Because I suppose some people would see a sex addiction as possibly more like paedophilia or those kind of things. Mm. People kind of extend that, what they think it might be or where they think it might go to. Does that make sense?
It does, yeah. I think there's a lot of social ignorance about sex addiction and porn addiction. Probably a lot of ignorance about most addictions, to be honest. The way we as professionals understand addiction is that it's a symptom of something else underlying for that client. You know, something's happened in their childhood, it's a trauma in their past. Maybe they struggle with other conditions like anxiety or depression, or have fragile self-esteem, and they will then turn to addiction, whatever kind of addiction it is, to self-soothe, self-medicate.
Do you think when they realise that, both people, the person who is addicted and the partner, if they're in a relationship, do you think that helps take some of the emotional conflict out of the relationship by kind of like saying, well, this is not me they're doing this to, this is because of, if you like?
Yeah, many partners eventually, once they've come through the emotional shock, and they can think more rationally, if you like, about what's going on, they start to see that actually their partner is in some way vulnerable to these things, and then partners will develop, you know, more empathy for what's happened. But just to come back to your point earlier about the social perception of addiction, and sex and porn addiction in particular, there is an attitude, I think, that sex and porn addiction means that somebody's dirty, perverted, weird, twisted, and this is a real shame that people think in this way. All we're talking about here is somebody that has some kind of need, and they're in a dysfunctional way trying to manage that need, emotional need, psychological need. Sometimes the behaviours do stray into looking at unlawful material online. This is where we get the question of things like paedophilia and so on, which is a very, very difficult area. A very difficult area indeed. If you think that in our so-called modern and liberated society we still have a lot of taboo around sex, and there are a lot of stigmas attached to certain types of sexual preferences. So we like to think that we're sort of open and liberal, don't we? But we're not. We're not really. It's still a very difficult topic for people to talk about. So when it comes to talking about people looking at images online, say of children, it becomes a very difficult topic. I'm not sure whether you want to get into that today, but it's
I think it's good that we mention it, because I think it's there. It's something that doesn't get mentioned, to be honest. And that's not saying it's okay. We're not saying that it's all right to do that. But I suppose, you know, the kind of internet, the kind of website kind of process now, it kind of takes you deeper and deeper and deeper, doesn't it? You kind of look at one image, and then that there's a pop-up, for example, and it'll give another image that's slightly more in a more deeper way, or a more constructive way of engaging. So I suppose it's like a rabbit hole.
Yes, there are those technical pitfalls, but I think as well the escalation effect of sex and porn addiction means that often sex addicts will seek out more extreme material to get that dopamine high.
Okay.
And for some, that leads them into looking at unlawful imagery, and it takes them into places like the dark web and so on. This is a small minority of people, and but we wouldn't describe them. They wouldn't fit the diagnosis for a paedophile.
No.
But they might fit the diagnosis for a voyeur. You know, they get excited by looking at these materials. They have no intention whatsoever of physically seeking out children. So this is what makes it a very difficult area. And people will very quickly label some porn addicts who have looked at this material as paedophiles.
So it's a small percentage of the
very
people.
Very small percentage. The reason I work with individuals that have found themselves in trouble with the police, I'm connected with an organisation called Stop So, and I mention them here because they're a marvellous organisation. They support people who are at risk of offending, want support, who have offended or been investigated. They do a fantastic job. But they refer out individuals to people like myself, and you know, they deserve support, as does anybody else having a difficult time. And it's that sort of client that really, really struggles with the guilt and the shame and the fear of being outed socially. And as we said earlier, the taboo and the stigma just makes it harder for them, because people don't really understand how this has come about.
Yeah, yeah. And you were saying stop, so is that kind of a register? Is that kind of a national register of people like yourself that they can refer to? Is there a website they can go to?
Yeah, Stop So is like a support and information organisation for people who are worried about offending or who, as I say, have offended. But they do keep a members list of people who they have trained to work with sexual offenders. So they do a fantastic job because it's for many not the most tasteful area of work to be doing, but we're all human and everybody deserves the support.
And it's good that there's people that can do that work.
Yes,
obviously, yourself, you know, because as you say, there's somewhere that they can go to talk about it, explore it, look at it, and to see it for what it is. Really?
Absolutely, absolutely. And if people have been caught by the police online or they've been reported by vigilantes or something like that and they are subject then to investigation, many of which, by the way, are not concluded, you know, they're thrown out because there's very little evidence or value in convicting people for looking at some images and with no intention of, you know, meeting children, then, yeah, that's a really difficult thing for people to go through. They might wait 12 months or 18 months for an investigation, and that can tear people's lives and families apart.
I would imagine so. So is it stopso.com or stopso.org.uk?
I think it's stopso.co.
.co.
No, must be the one, stopso.org.uk. .org.uk, is that?
.org.uk?
I think it is, yeah.
Yeah, okay.
But any Google search for Stop So, you know, people can find them.
Which is S-T-O-P-S-O?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Stop Sexual Offending, Stop S-O, yeah.
Right, okay. Can you give us some idea of what your programme looks like? What kind of things that people who come to you would get in that programme? How it works or the kind of steps it takes?
Yeah, so we're talking now generally about sex and porn addicts, not about those in
under investigation.
Offending. Yeah, so I always describe my work on as being on two levels. One level is enabling clients to stop their behaviours at some point and getting to abstinence and then move on into early recovery and then to build that recovery. The other level is trying to understand why the behaviour is there in the first place, and that's a whole different set of therapeutic support. As I mentioned before, it could be that the addictive patterns are a product of anxiety or depression or childhood experiences, traumas. I'm sure you've talked about many of these sorts of things in your other podcasts, but there is almost always a story behind the addiction. Very, very rare that the addictions occurred purely because somebody likes looking at pornography or they like messaging people online. There's, you know, there's something usually lurking underneath.
So would it be like a 12-step program that you go through or something like that with them?
Well, there are some overlaps.
Okay.
In my work, I suppose you describe it broadly, if we're thinking about the stopping work, as CBT work. So we're working on changing behaviours, changing thought patterns, putting new routines in place, a new lifestyle in place. Whereas the looking at the underlying aspects of it is more classic psychotherapy.
Can you give us an idea of what that kind of behavioural change would look like, CBT process? An example, just so people can understand it.
Yes, so let's take a porn addict, which is a very common presentation these days. A typical porn addict would be looking at 3 to 4 hours of pornography a day. It could be more extreme, could be way more than that, depends on somebody's work situation, of course, and whether they have a family. So the behaviour change is really in enabling them to reduce or stop that behaviour, which we call acting out, and to put in place more wholesome, more healthy activities. They might take up exercise or a new hobby or join a new social group. So switching from unhealthy behaviours to healthy behaviours.
Mm. Yeah.
Sounds straightforward, doesn't it?
Yeah, it definitely is not.
I always say to my clients, it's simple work. The steps are very straightforward and clear and obvious. Doing it is not quite so easy. What they will struggle with are cravings, very serious cravings resulting from withdrawing from a very intensive dopamine dependency over a long period of time. So a lot of the focus initially is on managing cravings. Usually that will involve engaging in some kind of distraction technique. So take up walking. I've had clients who have taken to online chess, or they've started meditating or taking up yoga. The list would be very, very long if I said what people found helpful as a distraction. But just doing something else when the cravings come on is a starting point.
So they change that behavioural process into something that's productive instead of destructive.
Yes, but what they're doing, importantly, is reducing the amount of dopamine dependency and gradually bringing that level down over time. It could be, I don't know, 5 to 6 weeks before they're really appreciating that they feel different. Some sooner, some a bit longer, but I find that's about the average. We're starting to get more in control, and the distraction techniques will come more easily.
Whenever I work with a person whose partner has been addicted in any way, shape or form, really, sometimes they kind of think, well, I need to take control of that aspect of their world. So, you know, if they're addicted to porn, well, you know, I don't let them have a phone. I don't let them have a laptop. I don't let them connect to the internet. I don't know whether or not, obviously, you can give me an insight into this, but for me, that doesn't necessarily, taking control of the entrance to the addiction doesn't necessarily help the addict, does it?
Not particularly. In fact, to step back a bit from your question, look at the broad span of it. We wouldn't expect a partner to be getting involved. Partners sometimes do have this natural inclination to try and control things, police things, but it puts on them extra pressure at a time when they need all their energies to focus on managing their own trauma from the discovery. But it's down to the addict really to take responsibility, to take ownership of this. And it's important for partners to see that they're doing that. Sometimes sex and porn addicts really struggle so much with their cravings, and they keep lapsing and relapsing, that to take away the internet is the only answer. You know, the technological controls are a sort of a last fallback, but even there they have to be switched back on gradually because an addict has to get back to normal life and normal living.
And I suppose if the addict's been involved in that decision process of taking away the internet, that's healthy. If they've been told they can't, it might not be, in a sense of not having control of their choice. Does that make sense?
Yeah, at all steps in this sort of treatment work, it's about collaboration with a client and developing ownership in their recovery program. It's not for me. And it wouldn't work anyway to impose and to set rules and so on. In fact, the first piece of work that we do as part of the stopping work is setting boundaries, and that's down to the client. You know, what are you going to stop doing? What are you going to introduce in your life that's more healthy? And let's stick with those boundaries.
Because I suppose if they're engaged in those choices, then they're more going to be engaged in getting through this process of weaning off the addiction, wherever that might be.
It's going to be more meaningful to them, isn't it, if they have set their own boundaries. You know, they're being responsible for themselves, they're being true to themselves. Mm. And most addicts want that. You know, they want to get back to being in control of themselves.
Mm. Yeah, I suppose at some point they find they're not in control. Yeah, I kind of relate it to a want and a need.
Mm.
If I need it, I'm not in control. If I want it, I am in control.
Mm. Yes, if it's a choice.
Yeah, there's a compulsion if there's a process. Yeah. And I suppose, you know, for the partner, if they do take control of that choice, then the addict probably is going to feel resentful and not necessarily want to engage with the process. They might pay lip service to it.
Mm.
They might say, oh, yeah, that's okay. But they'll be trying to find ways around that, I would imagine.
Yeah, I mean, obviously all recovering addicts are different. Some feel so distraught about the damage they've caused to their partner that they are willing to hand over control and meet all their partner's requests. That's okay up to a point, but as I said, we don't want to put pressure on partners to, you know, provide the means to recovery. That's not their role.
Yeah. They don't need to police it.
There's a method that I learned many years ago on the training, which I was very grateful for, which is called the three C's. So a partner needs to know that they haven't caused this addiction, they can't control it, and they can't cure it. Because these are the things that partners often feel they should be doing, and absolutely not.
Yeah, because even if they have a way of wanting to save, wanting to protect, then those three C's might come involved, won't they?
Absolutely.
You know?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's understandable to want to be caring for your partner and, or on the other hand, want to control them because, you know, you don't trust them.
Mm.
But that does take inner resources and energy to do at a time when a partner needs to focus on their own recovery.
Mm. It's difficult, isn't it?
It's very difficult. It's very difficult to guide and sometimes advise a partner because, you know, they've been hurt so much. And it sounds like we're trying to control a partner, but really all we're doing is trying to support them in the best way.
Mm. The motivation is right, but the execution might not be.
Yeah, at a very, very difficult time.
Yeah. Is, in your experience, after the many years of working in this area, is the life after addiction, porn addiction, sex addiction, can couples come through it?
Yeah, you'd possibly be surprised to know that in my let me say limited experience, because I'm not the all-world expert on this, but most couples don't separate. Most stay together. For some, the recovery is 3 to 6 months. For others, it's 18 months, 2 years. So, yeah, that surprises me, actually, still, that couples do work through this. And I suppose affairs and other infidelities in relationships are quite common, and people do manage to work through them successfully.
Mm.
Perhaps on the understanding that, you know, we all have our weaknesses and make mistakes sometimes, and we do our best to put it right again. It's a big sacrifice, a relationship, if you think about it, for these types of behaviours. But having said that, I'm very sensitive to the hurt that partners have caused.
Mm, indeed. So that model that you kind of utilise, do you think that's the most effective, i.e. that the addict basically wants to get helped? That's presumably the main driver, that I see this something that's not helpful, so I want to change my world, my life, my behaviour, whatever that is. That them doing that work with you, and then their partner, if they're in a relationship, gets support themselves to kind of cope with, hold that process until they're at a stage where they're okay. And then maybe I don't know, do some reconnective couple work, if
yes.
you like.
Yeah.
You think that's the best model?
Yeah, you've got it in one. It's the ideal process here, recovery process, is that the addict gets into a robust recovery. We're usually looking at a minimum of 3 months of abstinence, but I'd say a good sound recovery is beyond that, maybe 4 to 6 months. Ideally, a partner receives support of their own. It might not be quite as extensive as the addict's therapy, but that's usually very helpful. Once both of those recovery journeys have been completed, they can come back together then as a couple, and if need be, go and benefit from some couple therapy. Not all couples need that.
No.
But many do. And I almost always advise them to consider that anyway.
Yeah, to kind of do that rounding off, bringing together.
Yeah.
As a process.
Yeah, and it's not just about rebuilding, because sometimes the underlying reasons for an addict seeking out these behaviours is something that might also impact on the relationship. Let's say they have insecurities, emotional insecurities arising from childhood, absent parents or parents that separated or some other sort of trauma. That will almost always have an impact on how they behave in a relationship. And for example, rather than talk about their problems and issues with a partner, they will isolate and go off and look at porn. This is a very classic scenario. So getting a couple back together again will also be about how can you as somebody who isolates yourself, talk more. You know, how can you learn the skills of communicating, get over the fear of sharing things? So, but you'll know about that. You're doing a couple of work.
Well, yes, it is one of my areas of specialty. Yes. And, you know, I've found when there's been a secret, you know, whether that's an affair or, you know, there's been gambling or whatever, if the couple have worked through that to separately but then together in couple work, it tends to have a much more connected relationship. It tends to be a better relationship when they come through that process. I don't know if you feel the same way.
I wish I could say more on that, but for the best reasons, I don't see my clients at that stage normally. One or two come back. And from that, I know that the relationship is still going on, and they take responsibility for their recovery. They've maybe had a lapse, found themselves looking at some imagery online one day and thought, oh, right, I really must do something about this, which is good. They've come back to work through it. But I think the couple rebuilding and dealing with anything underlying there is important work. Very important work, but yeah, it can make a relationship stronger. It sounds a bit corny to say that. But the one thing that this sort of discovery or disclosure does is just opens up things that were closed before.
Yeah, that conversation, that dialogue, that sharing.
Yeah. So a partner would know more about the addict's emotional or psychological makeup, what's going on for them, because they've never shared that. They've always dealt with it by venting or medicating through, say, porn.
So there's always hope.
Absolutely. Yeah, as I say, most of the couples that I have worked with, they survive this. They come through it, and they haven't made the sacrifice. Of course, there are often children involved, so it would be a very big impact on children.
And the family work.
Yeah. We've spoken mostly about couples, but obviously there's a lot of clients I have that are not in a relationship.
Yeah. And I suppose their relationship with work, with friendships, that obviously will be affected by the addiction. Time they've spent doing it. So they might find that they're logging on online when they're at work, for example, and their employer might find a connection through their own internet, IT processes.
Yeah, sometimes I do, but With the new way of working now, hybrid working or working from home, I think there has been an upsurge in people accessing pornography. If I judge by people coming to me now and saying, well, you know, I work at home, so I have this opportunity, and I get a bit fed up at work or I get a bit stressed, I turn to pornography because I find it relieving or, you know, in some way de-stressing. So there is that. But people who are not in a relationship, yeah, these behaviours block relating. You know, everything seems to focus internally all the time.
Yeah.
And, you know, they're not out meeting people. So they're not going to, you know, find relationships very easily.
Mm.
Maybe that not being in a relationship has been part of the underlying cause for the addiction.
Mm. That sounds a bit like self-harm.
I think addiction is a form of self-harm.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's very self-destructive. Can be very harmful. I think sex and porn addiction is probably one of the least medically harmful addictions. But if you think about substance addictions, incredibly harmful from a medical health perspective.
Mm. Yeah, yeah. And I suppose looking at the wider aspect of addictions, I know, which you don't specialise in, with addictions with drugs and alcohol and those kind of things. But there are some overlaps, aren't they, by the sounds of it?
Yeah, I think the neurological process is common to all of them, in that the brain is struggling to deal with something, so it searches out some form of self-soothing or self-medication. Mm. So for some, alcohol helps them to numb the emotional pain. Mm. For some, it's drugs. For others, it's gambling. Mm. You know, the arousal and the stimulus they get from that anticipation of winning. For others, it's sex and porn. And I think, actually, luck and chance play a big part in this.
Mm.
So, for many of my clients, they were at an uncle's house and they discovered that uncle had some magazines under the bed, or but for others, they'll discover access to alcohol, maybe introduced to it by their peers.
Mm. Yeah, yeah. So in working that process of self-awareness, if you like, there can be a lot of, I don't know, people say to me whenever I've worked with any kind of addictive process, and I don't specialise in it, as you know.
Mm.
But they kind of say that, you know, if it was shopping addiction, for example, buying things, they buy the thing and they get excited about going to buy it, but then they put it away and they never look at it.
Mm.
It's that process of that heightened anticipation, that dopamine kind of process in your brain.
Yeah.
But once you've got it, then it doesn't give you the hit.
No.
So it kind of like, it raises, and then, dum.
Absolutely.
And then you need more and more.
Yeah.
Which is why people buy more and more expensive gear and more clothes, or take more and more drugs, or drink more and more alcohol.
Yeah.
Yeah. Is that your experience?
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, you've hit the neuroscience on the head there, because dopamine is central to all addictions, and it's particularly significant in sex and porn addiction, because sexual arousal gives us one of the highest hits of dopamine. So if you consider the intensity of pornography, where you can look at pretty much anything, and the supply of it is endless, so the anticipatory and the aspect of it and the novelty is perfect for dopamine.
Mm.
But of course, you know, we've always had dopamine. Once upon a time, it helped motivate us to go and find food and you know, survive.
Yeah.
But it's just got misappropriated now into unhealthy things.
Mm. Yeah, and which is society, isn't it? We have more and more opportunities to do that, aren't we? Really.
You know. Yeah, we're very much about consumption, aren't we? And you know, we get our thrills from buying you often things that are unnecessary, status symbols, and sometimes this can be the underlying factor for an addiction, because people don't feel that they're successful unless they've got a nice house, a nice car, gone nice holidays.
Mm.
And if they see their peers doing this, then at least a lot of self condemnation and this gets people down. This is why people experience anxiety and depression in our society, because they're not living up to what they think is the standard.
Yeah. And I suppose if they're doing that buying or taking or seeing, that kind of raising their anticipation, raising their heightened levels of dopamine, the down on that for a lot of things, I mean, maybe not with buying clothes or buying items, but certainly with taboo subjects like sex or drugs or things that are seen to be not right, I suppose that disgust of self, in a sense, once they've got to that point, kicks in as well, which might feed it even more. I don't know, does that make sense?
It does make a lot of sense, but we don't forget we see things from a different perspective as therapists. For most people, I don't think they think in that way. Yes, some clients are quite deep thinkers and they're quite reflective, but a lot of people aren't. You know, they get dragged along by the current, you know, and they get themselves trapped into this desire for all these material things, and not realizing that this is causing them the stress and the anxiety and the worry.
Yeah. They think it'll cure it, but it doesn't.
Yeah, they think that more is better. More will obviously cure it, but
yeah. I can get to a point where I've got enough, whatever that is, you know.
Yeah, I mean, I've experienced a lot of clients who have sort of opened their minds to different ways of thinking and living as a result of getting into recovery. They realise that they've been needlessly putting themselves under pressure to live up to standards that they're just unrealistic, just result in being stressed and worried.
Do you think that goes with addiction then, this kind of high achieve need to know perfect drive, if you like, or not?
I think that's one segment of it. There's definitely a group of addicts who put themselves under constant pressure to do well at work, to do well financially, to do well in material terms, and it just gets to a point where they just can't maintain or sustain that pressure, and they crack. It may be that they took to addiction a while back and it's helped them to maintain the perfect front, but behind that, really, really struggling. But that's definitely a segment of addicts that I see.
Yeah. And I suppose society kind of adds to that fuel, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Really, with more pressure and pressure and pressure, you know.
Yeah.
Need to do more, be more.
And sometimes I think it takes therapeutic conversations to help people understand that it's okay not to to want more all the time. It's okay to live a more moderate life and enjoy simple things, normal things, humble things.
That's been really interesting. Hopefully you have found it interesting as well, and the questions. Steve, if people want to get a hold of you, how can they do that to have those conversations?
The easiest way to go online, as is often the case, Esteem Therapy Yorkshire, they'll find me.
Okay, great stuff. Thanks for your time, Steve.
You're very welcome.
It's been really interesting.
Thank you.
And I say, if you've enjoyed this podcast, then obviously like and share it, because you never know, somebody that you connect to that you don't know is going through some situations like this might be helped by the process, and because it is such a secret process. My name's Ian Wallace, this is a Messed Up Counsellor, and this is Steve, my guest today. Thanks very much, Steve.
Thank you.